In Wayne Muller's book called Sabbath, he lays out a history lesson along with its modern application in a way that will make you cringe. He tells us this story. During World War II, British economists were asked to calculate all the resources available for fighting the war. They created a system that allowed them to keep a record of all goods and services bought and sold during the year. And from that, they calculated a number that they thought represented Britain's total wealth. When the war ended, the United Nations began using the British formula to compare the wealth of its member nations. If a country's manufacture, production, and sale of goods decreased, the country was in decline. If production and sale of goods increased, the country was healthy. In other words, the more money that changed hands, the more healthy the country. Today, all nations use this measurement, called the gross domestic product, or GDP, to assess national wealth and health. Did you catch that? Wealth and health. Muller then goes on to tell the story of two cousins to help us understand GDP on a more practical level. The first of the two cousins is a woman who lives in Somalia. She wakes up before dawn each morning, walks 2 miles to a fresh water well, and brings water home for her family. She feeds her children and sends them to school, works the entire morning in the family garden, spends the afternoon caring for the sick and elderly in her village, and works away the evening, cooking, mending clothes, loving her husband, and mothering her children. Her effect on the GDP, negative, negative, negative. She creates no product for resale. She is of no value. The woman's cousin went to military school. He trained as a pilot. He's ordered to fly a mission in his multi-million-dollar airplane and drop a bomb on a village believed to be hiding insurgents. After the bombing, millions of dollars are spent to bury the dead, to restore the buildings, to pay for police to restore order. The pilot's effect on the GDP? Plus, plus, plus. Muller isn't finished making his point, though. He goes on to tell us that a drive-by shooting improves the economy by $21,000. If the victim dies and there is a murder trial, the economy is boosted by over $100,000. All a plus for the GDP. All a sign of a healthy economy. That's messed up. If we're honest, we can admit, though, that it's not only the health of a nation's economy that we tend to tie to wealth. We associate personal wealth with effort, intelligence, sometimes good luck, and sometimes, I'm very sad to say, with God's favor. A quick history lesson. The word wealth comes from a word which originally meant in a state of good fortune, welfare, or happiness. It was a close cousin to the word health. But by the year 1430, the meaning of wealth became limited to riches and prosperity, leaving behind the older meanings of well-being and health. We've maintained that definition of wealth. Now, wealth is its own idol, its own industry. It is the ends and the means. It is the American dream. But if you look behind the curtain, you'll find that the pursuit of money is a rat race. It's a hamster wheel. Back when I taught high school sophomores, I used to joke that I could tell to the very day when a student turned 16. Their whole attitude seemed to shift as they reached that milestone of independence and autonomy, getting a driver's license. Many times when that independence and autonomy started showing up in declining grades, incomplete homework, tired and distracted students, I'd ask them about it. I was saddened when so many told me, without ever hearing the irony of it, that they were now working so they could get a car. They needed a car, they assured me. Why? I asked. So I can get to work. And I have to let you off the hook a little bit. I have to let you know it's not entirely our own fault that we've gotten caught on this hamster wheel. We have been played. Our mothers and fathers and grandmothers and grandfathers have been played. We've been taught to prize wealth, to pursue the things that money can buy at the expense of all the things that money can't buy. Jeffrey Kaplan wrote an article called The Gospel of Consumption for Orion Magazine. Listen to this. Private cars were relatively scarce in 1919, and horse-drawn carriages were still common. Electricity remained largely a luxury item for the wealthy. Just 10 years later, 1929, things looked very different. Cars dominated the streets. Most urban homes had electric lights, vacuum cleaners. In upper middle class houses, washing machines, refrigerators, toasters. But despite the apparent tidal wave of new consumer goods and what appeared to be a healthy appetite for their consumption among the well-to-do, industrialists were starting to get worried. They feared that the frugal habits maintained by most American families would be difficult to break. It was this concern that led Charles Kettering, director of General Motors Research, to write a 1929 magazine article called "Keep the Consumer Dissatisfied." He wasn't suggesting that manufacturers produce shoddy products. Along with many of his corporate cohorts, he was defining a strategic shift for the American industry from fulfilling basic human needs to creating new ones. By the late 1920s, America's business and political elite had found a way to diffuse the dual threat of stagnating economic growth and a radicalized working class in what one industrial consultant called the gospel of consumption. The notion that people could be convinced that however much they have, it isn't enough. President Herbert Hoover's 1929 Committee on Recent Economic Changes observed in glowing terms these results. Quote, by advertising and other promotional devices, a measurable pull on production has been created which releases capital otherwise tied up. And they celebrated this conceptual breakthrough. Quote, economically, we have a boundless field before us, that there are new wants which will make way endlessly for newer wants as fast as they are satisfied. We've been played. And I think we mostly know it, but we won't take ourselves out of that game. We need the rich man. We need Lazarus to come back from the dead, back from Hades, to tell us the truth about wealth, to teach us that the single-minded pursuit of wealth will impoverish us. There are so many warnings in this parable that we heard this morning. I'll share a few. First, that God's heart is always with the poor. Did you notice in this parable that the poor man is named Lazarus? And the rich man is named the rich man. Because the poor man, Lazarus, is the one who is important, the one who is known, the one who is offering us a chance to learn, to grow, to change. The rich man, well, he's one of millions, blind to those suffering around him, focused on the accumulation of his wealth, unconcerned about the state of his soul until it's too late. And second, there's a warning that we cannot become inured to the plight of the suffering. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen. He feasted sumptuously every day, and at his gate lay a poor man named Lazarus. And the rich man walked past him every day without noticing. Every single one of our unsheltered neighbors has a name, has a story, has a past, a present, and hopefully a different future. You cannot save them all. We cannot save them all, but we can acknowledge them. Hand the cup of water, the dollar bills, the clean socks, the sunscreen, with the assurance that we see them. The assurance that we will not step over them and take them for granted. Exchange names, not turn our eyes away in guilt or embarrassment or discomfort. And the third warning we get from this is you can't take it with you. The rich man also died and was buried in Hades, where he was being tormented. He looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side, and he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me, and send Lazarus to dip his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm in agony in these flames." Friends, the one who dies with the most still dies. The things we truly need to sustain us, and I'm talking here about those of us in this room who mostly have all of our basic needs for food and shelter met, the things we truly need to sustain us, like faith and hope and love, cannot be bought. And four, with a horrific lack of grace, we often assume that the poor are responsible for their own plight, and we make them responsible for ours as well. "Then, Father Abraham, I beg you, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers, that he may warn them so that they will not also come into this place of torment." Send the poor man to warn the rich brothers. No. The rich brothers have their own scriptures. They have their teachings. Let them heed them. We know what we must do. We cannot wait for the poor to rise up in their own revolution, which we will then underwrite. We cannot stand idly by and let other activists, other people with a conscience, do all the work. We have the prophets. We have the scriptures. Let us heed them. Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these children of mine, you did for me. And finally, Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. They should listen to them." The rich man said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." Abraham said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced, even if someone rises from the dead." They will not believe it if someone rises from the dead. They will not believe it if someone rises from the dead. Last week I told you that money was like water. I told you the story of Gertrude from Lynn Twist's book, The Soul of Money. Money is like water, Gertrude said. For some folks, it rushes through their life like a raging river. Money comes through my life like a little trickle. But I want to pass it on in a way that does the most good for the most folks. I see that as my right and my responsibility. It's also my joy. Money is like water. When it's moving, it carries along the energy of all our commitment. It carries our very souls. When money flows from us, it carries a bit of our spirit. When it doesn't flow, it holds in guilt. It holds in smallness. It holds in indifference. What if I told you today, in the lagging 100-degree heat of a Texas September, that money was like fire? What if I told you that you can't collect it, only use it? What if I told you money was like fire? When you have it, when you get too comfortable in the light of it, you no longer look beyond it to the dark edges where Lazarus sits. What if I told you money was like fire, that used carelessly, it can destroy us, but used wisely, it can warm us in the winter, cook our food, light the darkness, forge steel? What if I told you money is like fire, that there is enough for every single person who needs light, warmth, energy? What if I told you money is like fire, that it leaves a trail, that just as wildfire burns a visible path, so does our money, that your bank account, your credit card receipts will show where you've used the power of your money? And what if I told you, last of all, in the words of Lewis Lapham, money is like fire. An element as little troubled by moralizing as earth, air, and water. Humans can employ it as a tool, or they can dance around it as if it were the incarnation of a god. It acquires its meaning from the uses to which it is put. Amen.